Okay, my name's Jim Willing. Well, we'll hit the specific introduction part here in a second. What I'm going to talk on today is kind of one of my pet peeve subjects, is getting real computer education back into the schools. And part of this will be incorporating the use of classic computers and reference material to introduce the mechanics of the computer. By way of it, see if I can manage to do this without keep walking away from the mic. By way of introduction, like I said, my name is Jim Willing. Some of you may have run across one of my works. I maintain a virtual museum of classic computer equipment and related paraphernalia out on the web called the Computer Garage. For anybody who wants to go trolling, the URL for the site is out here. In real life, I'm currently employed as a support systems engineer for the Intel Corporation. I've been there a little over 7 years. I've been actually involved in the computer business, specifically the microcomputer business, for a little over 23 years now, getting in back in the early Altair days, and I've been there ever since. Well, a couple of things for anybody who's sat through one of my talks before, or those that haven't, let me lay out a couple of quick ground rules. First off, basically, there are no ground rules. If you want to jump in with a question, please go ahead. I'm not a professional speaker. I don't always talk well to slides, although, you know, this is kind of the nature of the beast. Some people have asked, especially when I go out and speak on this topic, I'm not a professional educator. I've been in computers all my career, basically. And, you know, so any time at all you want to jump in with a question, fine. Don't be afraid to interrupt me. If I say something just horrendously stupid and you want to call me on it, that's fine too. If I gloss over something or miss something on a slide that you're interested in, stop me. We'll go back and cover it. Hopefully I don't have to back up on the slides because I never can figure out how to do that. Okay, why am I doing this? A couple of reasons. Today, honestly, computers are more complicated today than they have ever been. And that's regardless of what people will talk to you about, you know, ease of use, user-friendly, all this noise. Yeah, from a consumer level, yes, that's true. Computers are a lot more accessible today than they have been in the past, but internally they are massively more complicated, more complex entities than they have ever been since they were invented. We're not talking a matter of just mere parts count here, you know, how many machines how many parts the ENIAC had versus how many parts are in your current PC, but in the complexity of the machine itself and its operating environment. Anybody who's tried to chase down a problem in Windows can probably attest to that one. It can be catastrophic. Also, from the educational standpoint, the commoditization of the computer has forced a change in the focus of educators, and at least my view on it and the view I seem to find of a lot of other people is this has not been a change for the good. While computers are showing up in the schools far earlier than they ever had before. Children are being introduced to computers at a far earlier age. Things like, you know, anywhere from the utilitarian functions like word processing and like all the way up to the internet. There is a severe lack of education out there in like the pre-collegiate grades of the actual mechanics of how the thing works. It's being treated as an appliance. If you can find the power switch and find the icon, you are now a computer operator. But that's also causing a lot of people, adults and children alike, to be extremely frustrated when something goes wrong and they have no clue what to do about it or even where to look because they have no idea how the thing works. And this doesn't have to be, when I say how it works, I don't necessarily mean down at the nut, bolt, piece, part, gate level. The very basics of how these fool things go. Yes?
All right, so how different is that then?
Probably very little. I mean, at the root. The question was just for the sake of the archival audience. The question was, how does this differ from not being taught how a car works, or not being taught how, or the phone system. Like I said, at the root level, looking at it as an appliance, there's very little difference. But access to that sort of information tends to be a lot more readily available. You can go down to any store, pretty much. You can go over to G.I. Joe's or whatever your favorite auto parts store is and find shop manuals for your car if you want to know how the car works. The other aspect is, and the difference here to a large extent, or the perceived difference in my viewpoint, is that the car does not serve the same as much as I hate to throw, you know, industry cliches in, the same mission critical function that a lot of people have imposed on their computers. If your car breaks down, you normally have options. Many families have a second car. There's mass transit. There's, you know, there's carpools. There's things like that. Your world does not necessarily end if your car breaks down. You can take it somewhere. You can get it serviced. It's a fairly known quantity. If you like to be a Saturday mechanic, you can crawl under it and generally do fairly minimal amounts of damage as long as you don't take too many parts off. On the other hand, either in business or in home or in home businesses, which are more and more prevalent, the computer has become such a central item, a central focus of so much that goes on, from people communicating via email or people doing their daily news trolls out on the internet, or, you know, your recipes, your home, your household budget, or whatever, that when that thing fails, or it has a problem, or something, it tends to become a catastrophe. Even if it's just somebody who's so obsessed with playing the latest video game, they can't play for a couple of days and they're having video game withdrawal. Although that's actually a direction I promised I wasn't going to go into. It is relatively tough to go out and find decent reference material in the market these days, even at the larger booksellers, of really the nuts and bolts of how computers work. The other problem is, even if you can find something, there's a lot of books out there on how to upgrade your PC, which is fine. The problem again with that is, however, the PC is a horrendously complicated operating environment. I would not want to try and teach anybody really low-level basics of computers on a PC, because unless you lobotomize the thing to just horrific extent, it's relatively difficult to go out and write some low-level basic code on the thing for demonstrations that you don't have to deal with the BIOS, you don't have to deal with the interrupt structures, the timer subsystems, all this other noise that's immediately turned on as soon as you turn the power on in the thing. In the, you know, at the level of education I came out of back when I was getting into the industry, you would not have attempted to get near an environment as complex as that until probably like a third year college computer sciences course. Because there are too many concepts out there, interrupt systems, timer controllers, all these other things that are just way beyond the sort of things you need to know at a fairly basic level. Which is one of the reasons I rarely use PCs when I go in and make talks at schools and the like. Somewhere in there, did I kind of address your question?
Well, sort of not. I mean, okay. In schools today, if you want to learn about engines, for example, they start you out on a two-stroke lawnmower engine, and they work you up to, you know, a 400 cubic inch GM monstrosity.
Right? Yeah, I took auto shop. I remember that.
So, I mean, computers are much the same way. Although, you know, I agree with you. I would start someone on a PC. But there are small, relatively simple architecture machines you can start people on that are, you know, at least as the same complexity as, say, the PDPA.
Yeah, the trick is finding them in the schools. Find me schools in the public school system in particular that have them, that have access to them. What you're going to go into the schools, you're going to find in some schools you're still going to find Apple IIs. More commonly, in a lot of them, you're going to find Macs and the like. These days are big PC labs.
Right.
And sorry.
Your thesis is that teaching computer architecture, or at least internals, is the goal. And I think computer awareness, or teaching people who use computers every day, have to learn how basically a computer works. They don't have to learn about registers, they don't have to learn about memory management units, PLDs, but they need to know that, you know, RAM goes away when the power turns off, and hard disk doesn't, and, you know, that kind of stuff.
You would think so, but you'd be amazed at the number of people out there that don't. And that's the thing that gets me. I'm not necessarily advocating that we try and have everybody programming an assembler by the time they get out of the sixth grade. But what I am trying to get out there, and what my work in the schools has shown so far, is there's a lot of interest out there in knowing more of the basic mechanics of the thing beyond the power switch and Windows and the icon. And that's kind of the level I'm shooting at. And as I'll cover in here later, there are opportunities we've got today that were basically unprecedented in the industry for people that want to go beyond that. Okay, so let me wander on here, and we'll see if I hear your points. But again, jump in. Aside from the appliance approach that is being assigned to computers today. The average classroom teacher now that has been tasked with doing introduction to computers and the like does not have the background in the basics, the basic mechanics of computers. If you keep in mind, you know, 10, 20 years ago, when probably a lot of, well, some of them may have still been coming out of school or a little further back for those of us who don't want to admit to it, the computer instructors in the school, they were pretty much exclusively the advanced math teachers or the high-end, you know, physics science teachers whose backgrounds were applicable largely to the sort of things you dealt with in computers. Algebraic notation, things like that, logical progression, problem solving, things like that. Whereas today, we've imposed the introduction on even the grade school levels, you know, second, third, fourth grade, where the teachers still, by necessity, are more generalist. They teach a number of different subjects, and they don't necessarily have the advanced math or, you know, algebraic level problem solution skills that would have been present in the instructors that were teaching computers, you know, 20 plus years ago. And I don't fault them for that. You know, this is something that has been imposed on them because it is accepted. A bulk of the population out there are going to have computers. They're going to be using them, and they need to. It is a good thing that we are introducing people, you know, children and everybody else, to these things earlier on. One of the big stumbling blocks that was frequently referred to, you know, 15, 20 years ago when the personal computer movement first started was technophobia. People were scared to death of computers because what they knew of them were they were these big, horrendously complex items that were locked away in rooms and managed and lorded over by lab-coated wizards, you know, that you if you needed the computer to do something for you, you came up, you made proper supplications, handed them your deck of cards or whatever, and 2 or 3 days later, you'd get back a 4-foot-thick printout saying, basically, wrong. And that attitude was pervasive through the industry for a number of years. It's probably been only in the last 5 to 7 years that the computer has started to be considered to be more of an appliance, more of an accessible tool than this big enigmatic monster. But again, that's, in my view, that's kind of good and bad. The next thing is the people coming out of the school system today scare the living daylights out of me because of their lack of knowledge in fundamentals. I'm working with a person who just finished a 2-year, you know, like associate degree course in computer sciences, and I got tied up with him installing a new phone and telephone network in our church for a big new extension. Seemed fairly straightforward. They wanted to network all the PCs together. They wanted to have a host. They wanted to tie to the internet. To me, you know, that's fine. This guy just came out with this degree. I figured, hey, this should be easy. He's a nice guy. But real world, he's functionally clueless. He has no real base of experience to work from, even though he's got the paper that says he's good. He has a disturbing lack of understanding of the fundamentals of how to work with something at a bit of a lower level. Yeah, the machines are running Windows, so we would expect that to be decent. We've got a Unix server that's overseeing the whole thing. But we've got a network infrastructure to build. They want the thing to tie into the internet. They want to be able to get email in and out. They want to set up a web page. A lot of things that we take for granted that, you know, is out there and a lot of people are doing. But again, these are horribly complex tasks that the bulk of us are only able to do because somebody has put the time and the energy and the resources out there to hide all the complexity behind these increasingly enormous programs. As much as I frequently hate to attribute anything sensible to a politician, one of the best quotes I heard from all the Bill Gates hearings that were on like C-SPAN here a few months back, when one of the congressmen, I think, asked Bill Gates, why does it take 38 million lines of code to write a letter? And that's one Gates didn't even have a good question for. Why is it? Why has the operating environment and the system spiraled so out of control that today we need multiple megabytes of memory and multiple gigabytes of hard disk space to store things that we were doing, maybe not as elegantly and maybe not with as much eye candy, but the same applications we were doing 20 years ago in 48 or 64 kilobytes of memory? Why has this thing spiraled out of control? And even to the extent that a lot of the I tend to interact with a lot of, you know, a lot of designers and programmers and engineers just as, you know, part of my real life job. And same thing. They're very well schooled in high-level system design. They know how to make C++ compilers jump through hoops. But if they ever had to go in and look at a chunk of assembler code, their eyes would glaze over, they'd fall off their chair. They don't understand it. They don't know where it comes from. They don't know how this stuff works. You know, and one of the reasons, I think, or in a lot of cases, again, it becomes that kind of split issue between the commoditization issue, where we've got a market that turns over so rapidly, so dramatically, that, you know, there's a new software release, or there's a new machine, or there's something new every 3 or 4 months that barely allows time to finish a piece of code, let alone debug it. But you've also got this, this pervasive lack of the underlying fundamentals. A lot of these people, they don't know how to debug code. If they don't get a warning or a fault from their compiler, they assume it's going to work. And you look at things, it'll probably sound like I'm ragging on Windows, which I shouldn't, because that's part of what pays the bills. But you look at the amount of times that you're confronted with the infamous blue screen of death. Or you put in a new video card or a new sound card or something, and suddenly your machine that's been behaving just marvelously for the last year and a half suddenly becomes a psychotic piece of electronics that falls over every 5 minutes. That I believe still results from a large part of this lack of knowledge of these fundamentals, of how all this stuff has to interact. Because everything has been moved to a very high level. There's high level programming APIs or stuff. There's chunks of code I've looked at recently that have come out of, engineers I'm very good friends with. I kind of came out of the old school. We wrote assembler all the time. I did operating system work way back when. And one of the simplest concepts that we were always hit with is when you're starting up a new piece of code, you're launching a program, you go out, you initialize your variables. This is a no-brainer to me. I don't know how many pieces of commercial software I have fired up lately, granted a lot of it is beta stuff, but some of the stuff that's made to market, that you launch the program and 4 times out of 5, it falls over, or it doesn't launch, or it comes up and mumbles about something really screwy. And by the time you go back and you beat on somebody and you make them figure out what the heck went wrong, you found, I forgot to initialize this pointer. Hello? You build a new variable. We're not working in the world of BASIC anymore. A newly initialized variable does not come up with a value of 0. I'm sorry, registers don't think that way. Compilers today don't think that way. It's this fundamental knowledge, the stuff that we've learned over the last 40, 50 years in computing that is being lost. And that's one of the reasons, it's one of the reasons I do things like this. I drag myself out to these computer festivals. People ask, why are you doing this? Wired Magazine came, I got an email from them a couple days ago. They said, why are you interested in stuff like this? And I told them, because this is a way, and taking things like these classic machines into the schools is a way to illustrate a lot of the basic principles, a lot of where this came from, and try and preserve some of this knowledge that seems to be fading out of the collective consciousness these days. It's a small part, and like I said, I'm not trying to create sixth grade assembly level programmers. I'm not even assuming that anybody's going to be able to program anything useful in BASIC after they've sat through a couple of my talks in a school. But what I want them to see is that there's something behind the keyboard. That in itself is the title of one of the presentations I do, where we just go over, at a very, very high level, basic mechanics of computers, which have not changed fundamentally since the computer was created, over the course of about 40 years. Because if you think about it, the basic structure of a machine, regardless of if it's, you go back to something like the ENIAC, or you go up to today's PC, or a Cray sitting off in the corner, or whatever, there's always still going to be 4 basic sections. Okay, you're going to have an input. There's going to be some form of input into the machine. Keyboard, tape reader, scanner, whatever. Be a way to get the data into the machine. It's going to be a way to get the data out of the machine. Be it a printer, a screen, plotter, whatever. You'd be amazed how many people I will mention plotter to and their eyes glaze over. What's a plotter? Sometimes I'll show them one. They go, oh, that's neat. There's going to be a computation unit, your logic, arithmetic, control unit, CPU, if you prefer, And there's going to be storage. It's going to be long-term storage in the form of some sort of disk, tape, whatever. And there's going to be short-term storage, core in the older machines, RAM in current machines. There are still people who out there that don't realize when you turn the machine off, it all goes away. They still don't know. Okay, so why do this with classic computers. And for the sake of discussion, I've kind of signed on to the term that seems to be more or less generally accepted, at least around the collector's community, that a classic computer is qualified as something that is at least 10 years old and usually out of production, which qualifies, you know, basically everything in my collection. One of the most important things I found in taking things into the school is the classic machines eliminate the newest game mindset. Because if you go in there with a PC or a laptop or something they immediately recognize, a lot of people want to know, do you have the latest game? Do you have the latest version of Doom or Quake or whatever? And it's a distraction. Does it play games? How fast is your CPU? Yada, 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 yada. You know, if I want to go out and talk to somebody about PCs, I'll go talk about PCs and I'll bring the games along. But this isn't the track I'm going here. So we get away from that mindset by giving them something that's different. It may be at least peripherally recognizable as a computer, because they'll go, oh, wow, I saw that in a science fiction movie once. But at least it won't be a PC, so they won't immediately start asking for games. Demonstrations can be done with a fairly minimal amount of coding, because we don't have to deal with all the, you know, the legacy issues of the PC environment. Timers, interrupt controllers, all this other noise. You know, my average code demonstration, when I'm talking about somebody about seriously coding at a machine level or a very low, you know, somebody wants to know what sort of instructions really does the machine operate on, I can, you know, on one of my front panel machines, I can toggle in 20, 30 bytes of code and have a good running illustrative demonstration. Rather than the infamous, you know, if you want to compile Hello World under Windows, it comes out to a half meg executable. It's like, oh, please. Okay. We're able to single step through the program logic. Again, this is more critical in places where you are dealing with the lower level mechanics of the computer, how it processes the instructions. But you can take this through step by step. And it doesn't matter really what your console configuration is on the thing. I've done this with all sorts of things. I've got my Altairs, which are switches and lights. I've used some of the H8s from my collection, which have a little hex keypad and numeric displays. I've got some old Heathkin microprocessor trainers that sometimes I use when we're throwing an electronic spin on this. But you can get that level of control of the machine. I don't know how many of you have looked lately, but you say, well, hey, we could do that with debug under DOS. You tried to find debug on a Windows machine? Have you tried to find BASIC on a Windows machine lately? It ain't there. It doesn't install. They still give it to you because people scream to Microsoft, but to find it, you have to go trolling around and find the old DOS directory on your Windows installation CD and manually copy the files in. And then run it all in a DOS window and hope the thing doesn't GPF on you every time you try and single step through a BASIC statement. So, you know, pass that. But again, this is me. Okay, this is my take on it. If you want to go out and do demonstrations with PCs, more power to you. But again, I think that's more complicated a level than I'm trying to address most of the time. It provides, you know, the classic machines provide a manageable operating environment. You know, they don't fall over, they don't crash, there is no blue screen of death. They're controllable. Yeah. And one aspect that I think should not be overlooked is it provides it provides interaction with history, historical items. It provides an opportunity to go in there and touch these things. Okay, a lot of people say, why, you know, I can't envision taking a Sol to a classroom because it doesn't do anything whizzy. If it's not playing Doom, they're not going to be interested. Bunk. I've taken Sols to classrooms. If somebody wants to see a little example of how games used to be, I'll fire up Target or Star Trek or something. And, you know, we have to pry kids off of the thing 2 or 3 hours later. It's not color. There's no fancy graphics. But there's a fascination to it. I have the problem with my own two sons. One just started high school or junior high this last year. The other's in grade school. They've been around me all their lives. They see me, you know, guessing with this stuff all the time. But if I fire up one of these machines and leave it running, I will probably be out there having to crowbar them off of it a little later. Because they want to play with it. They want to, you know, they may not know how to program the thing. They may not know much more about it than it's a computer. So it's whatever computer daddy's working on this week. But there's a fascination with an old piece, a piece of history. in some of the demonstrations we've done in the schools and some supplies I've provided for other people I've worked with doing demonstrations. Here's a scary one. I give them sets of punch cards. Think that one over. Your old standard 80-column IBM Hollerith punch card. And kids eat those things up. We take them out and I punch for an example, a game that we use in some of the presentations of how do computers store information. Okay, you can stand up there and rattle on about bits and bytes and stuff like this, but it's a very abstract concept if you have never worked with it. The idea that a computer doesn't understand, when you type 2 on a keyboard, that's not what the computer sees. It's a bunch of bits that become a representation of a character, which may be dealt as a text item or a numeric item, depending on the format in the field. You've lost 95% of your audience, if not the whole thing. But I take a set of punch cards out. I have a key punch and a card sorter and other various accoutrements in the collection. And every time I find a homeless box of punch cards somewhere, it goes home with me. You'd be amazed. A lot of people still out there use them for note cards. That's their option to the post-it note. Not if I get a hold of them. I'll punch up a couple of cards. One will be a key card. It will just have the entire character set with the interpreter turned on, so the character is printed across the top of the card. And then we'll give them a bunch of cards with the interpreter turned off, so it's full of holes, but there's no words. It becomes a decoding game. Use the first card to read the secret message. And this is a very concrete example that they can look at and they can touch and they can work with that illustrates how computers store information. By the time they've gone through this, we've gotten out of the abstract, and a lot of them go, well, this is neat. And they say, well, can I do this myself? Yeah, so if you want to, they'll draw a little punch card and they'll color them in. They'll start sending, tossing messages back and forth in the class to annoy the teacher. Yes?
Can we use a cardiac?
I'm coming up to that. Okay, believe me, I'm coming up to that. In fact, if you're not the one I got the information from, I've got some information coming on that you'll love. But, and, you know, I'm still hearing, I started this thing with punch cards at an organized event, which I will cover here a little later in the talk, that I made up sets of punch cards for a couple of other people that were going to the schools 2 years ago. And people are still coming to me and talking about how excited their kids were to have these things. You know, I figured if we got the concept across, that would be something. But they still remember it 2 years later. I think we hit something. So, okay, following this topic just a little bit. Again, we can also use this to illustrate the similarities between the older machines and their contemporaries. Like I said, aside from the ideas of pipelining data cache, L1 cache, L2 cache, turbo this, bazunga what, the basic underlying structure of the machine hasn't changed. I don't care if it's a PDP-8 or a PC. You've still got the same guts going through the same sequences. And okay, started back in 1951 by the National Society of Professional Engineers, comes up in February every year around George Washington's birthday, who was a military engineer and land surveyor. That was a good tie-in. And in particular at Intel and some of the other high-tech companies, what they do is give us very liberal amounts of time away from our jobs during that week to go into the schools and make presentations on things related to engineering. It can be computers, it can be any topic that you're comfortable with talking with. But again, it's intended to go out and get some interest and get them to start thinking about it and asking questions. And I've been doing that for about 3 years now. In fact, that's where I started the thing with the punch cards here a couple of years ago. I floated it out as an idea I was thinking about using in my presentation, and some of the other people in my building heard about it. And I spent like 3 or 4 hours the next couple of days punching and duplicating punch cards for about 24 sets of these things that people wanted to take to classrooms all over the place. Then we've got some more, some things you might not consider right off. School functions, carnivals, fundraisers, things like that. The carnivals. Again, I use the robots a lot in these things. I'll take them out, put them in a little field, and put a ball out there. And we start playing a little game. We have like a 4x4 area or 8x8 area marked off. And I put a little program in the robot to basically seek an object within the barrier and pick it up and take it to somebody. Just arbitrarily, if you can get a hold of it, pick it up and head for the wall. You would be amazed. You know, we'll have kids standing 10 deep around this little arena, watching this thing chase around, trying to catch this ball. And if we really want to have fun, you know, you buy a ticket, I'll give you two balls, you can throw them into the arena, we can really confuse this poor thing. And they'll look at that for a while, and then you'll get the ones that'll start asking, okay, how does it do that? And that becomes your entry. You know, initially, if you go to some of the schools, say, oh, I'd like to bring a robot in, they go, why? Some do. A lot of the schools, maybe my district is a little more open to these things, but, you know, I offered that just kind of in passing, and, you know, now they call me on a regular basis. You know, go out and have fun with it. Yes?
Who do you contact at the school? Do you just cold call people? Do you cold call teachers?
A lot of times I talk with the teachers of the classes my sons are in, because I have children in school. I go and talk to the principal or like some of the open houses and stuff. I go and I'll talk to some of the teachers in the math and science departments and just say, you know, I've got some of these things around and I've done these things on occasion. If you're at all interested sometime, you know, give me a call. And it, like I said, it's not a sales pitch. I'm not trying to sell them anything. And, you know, like I said, if I had the time, I'd be out there nonstop. I also have out on my website an outline of presentations for the link off my main pages for schools and organizations that has basic outlines of about a half dozen different presentations that I've organized. And if they want information, I point them there. I give them my phone number, say, you know, give me a call. And like I said, fortunately, Intel is very flexible when it comes to their employees working in the school. So I get a lot of, you know, I have a lot of opportunity to work with this, and you know, management staff and the like are very understanding, which I very much appreciate. Like I said, carnivals, fundraisers, scout groups, which tend to be affiliated with the schools or at least tend to use school buildings a lot. That's another one of those things that just tears, you know, tears my heart out. Back when I was in scouting, way back when, you know, there was a computer merit badge, and that required some serious work, you know, to understand computers and be able to explain to the other people in your troop the basics of how a computer works, even if it's just very basic that the computer, all it does is a dumb box that follows instructions, and you can show, you know, on five cards how you can add two numbers. That would work. The merit badge requirements for today are use a word processor, create a database. What's up with that? That bites. You know, I'm sorry, but no. No. Also, some of the things I like to go out there and for the next slide or two, I promise not to rag on Microsoft, maybe. Go out and expose a myth or two. You know, a favorite one. Computers are infinitely fast. Well, then why are you already complaining about your 400 megahertz Pentium 2 processor with 64 gig of memory is too slow? You know, give them a basic tell them what instruction time is. Tell them how long it really takes this thing to add a couple of numbers, as opposed to how long it takes to add a couple of numbers in Windows. I'm sorry. Or the idea computers can do multiple things at once. No, they can't. Multitasking is smoke and mirrors. Unless you have multiple processors, and we're not going to, I don't want to take this down to the persnickety level of, you know, dual pipelining and current processors and stuff like that. Computers only do one thing at a time. If you're running Windows, I don't care if you have 40 windows open and they all seem to be doing something, only one of those is really ever doing anything at a time. And that's after you get some part of the 40% of the computer's headspace that's left after it's done all the screen painting. You know, again, some of these things are just starting to help people understand why their computer frustrates them so badly. Why do I have to go buy a 400 meg Pentium 2 this week? Otherwise, all my stuff's going to be too slow. Yeah. And, you know, a great one, computers think. Well, without drifting down the path of neural networks and the like, they don't. They only do what they're told. You know, granted, they do it in a real hurry. Now, granted, one of these days we may come up with the optimal Turing machine, and we can debate that one around for hours, but, you know, for the moment. You know, computers never make mistakes. And yes, before anybody knows, it is spelled wrong in on purpose. You know, and the old famous adage, you know, garbage in, garbage out, period. the computer isn't going to fix your logic for you. It's not going to fix your program for you. It's not going to balance your checkbook. My computer gave up trying to balance my checkbook years ago. I am hopeless. Computers will replace people. Okay, fine. Yeah, right. Who's going to build the computer? Who's going to program the computer? You know, yeah, people have been displaced by computers. People have been displaced by assembly lines. You know, that's one of those arguments you can go on with forever, but, you know, why? And okay, I'm sorry, it's there. Computers started with Windows and were created by Bill Gates. No. Sorry. Mm-mm. Now, for the people, I'm going to push the button here real quick because I inserted a slide somewhere in here that I don't have in my notes. I'm going to see if it's here. Okay, no. Okay. When you get into a class or a situation where they want to get more advanced, okay, they want to know, okay, you've got the basics of how it works. How do operating systems work? How do you coordinate all this stuff? Today, and this is one of the things I will give credit to the PC revolution, getting computers in front of so many people. We have today unprecedented access to operating system source code that is unheard of in the computer industry. When I was in school, it was only the elite in the class that ever got to go in the back room where they kept the source code for, you know, Ristus or whatever on microfiche. You know, BSD Unix really only exists because it was the perpetual class project for the advanced computer science classes at UC Berkeley. If you were good, you got to go play with the operating system. Otherwise, you're just another one of these batch job schmucks. You know, out there today, we can get access to stuff that was unheard of 5 years ago. Okay, how many people remember CPM? Just let's gauge the audience here. Oh, good. Okay, the entire sources for CPM are out available on the web now. Caldera, who owns the rights to all the digital research software today, they haven't released it, but they've authorized a guy by the name of Tim Olstead out of Texas, who has created the unofficial CPM website. He has been allowed by Caldera, or Caldera, never can keep those straight, to distribute on the web the complete sources for all the digital research 8-bit software. It's all out there. CPM, MPM, the utilities. Well, at least the NPM stuff is going there. I'm for reasons I won't go into right at the moment, I have a lot of the original DRI CPM material or NPM materials, which I'm in the process of transferring to Tim as we speak. Like I said, CPM, NPM, DRDOS, the digital research version of DOS, if you want to do something PC compatible, is available from the Calera website on a non-commercial or educational basis for no charge. Unix, we've got all the variants. We've got pre-BSD, NetBSD. It's all free. It's downloadable from the web. If you don't have the bandwidth, you can go out and buy it on CD for $20-$30. Linux, which is catching on amazingly. Again, that's available free for download off the web or commercially on CDs, anywhere from like $5 up to $50, depending on how pretty you want it packaged and what sort of supporting utilities you want. And all these things come with complete source code. If you've got somebody who wants to go out there and look and see how does a basic system, a basic operating system work? How do you manage storage on a disk? How do you manage memory? How do you do multitasking? How do you do multi-user? The resources are out there and they don't cost anything. You know, there's another one of the big obstacles they had in the schools and still have today is cost. You can supply them with this for like nothing. Or the cost of, 75 cents for a recordable CD. Yeah. Thank you. Somebody looked at his watch, and I'm rambling over time. So I'll try and kind of blow through the balance of this. I guess the end run is, things to keep in mind here if you're considering, going out and working with the schools on this. Don't bury the message in the details. Don't go to a third or fourth grade class and start talking assembler. Deal with things at the level of like a cardiac or the game with punch cards. If you don't have a key punch out in the garage, take some index cards and a hole punch. It doesn't have to be ASCII, it doesn't have to be 8-bit, as long as you can keep the holes lined up. But don't over-confuse people. And something I agonize over all the time is dealing with the audience, gauging the audience. And when you're working in the schools, that's real easy. Go talk to the teachers. They know better than anyone. Which, is the next point, know the audience. Don't talk over their heads. And don't be afraid to try something different. It could be punch cards, it could be the robots, it could be, almost anything. As long as you can build an example around it, it doesn't have to be structured. Always, here's one just as a note, always prepare additional material for a couple of reasons. As I said, sometimes I'll get a class that they're brains, right? And they blow through everything. You know, I figure a 45-minute presentation, they blow through everything in 20 minutes. Please don't get in a situation where you're standing there with your hands in your pockets for 20 minutes going, You know, have an extra example or two, or an extra demo or two, kind of in your back pocket, in case you need something to fill time, or occasionally you'll be going down a direction and you'll see just everybody glazing over. Pull something out different. Like I said, try something different. Even if it's the same concept, just changing direction a little will often save a presentation. Whenever possible, try to relate your presentation to a current topic of study, you know, especially in the schools. And that's not hard. You know, even if it's something general like problem solving, you know, a computer or a robot can be applied to that real easily. Okay. And, you know, work with the teacher, you know, teacher instructor, whatever the facility is. Like I said, they're going to know the environment better than you will, being able to come in once or twice over the course of a month or a year. You know, they'll be an invaluable source of information. You know.
Yeah. Go on.
And don't be excessively rigid in a program. You know, don't just go up there and lockstep through something. Because the first time you do that, you're going to lose people 20 minutes into it. You know, leave yourself the leeway to fan off in some different directions. Let the discussion start firing up. You know, oftentimes I worry about filling time, and I find out, you know, once we get a discussion started, 47 minutes, I could have filled 3 hours, you know, usefully. But, you know, you got to get their attention first. You've got to get them thinking, get them asking questions. Which also leads up to one, don't be afraid to improvise. You know, and sometimes that will depend a lot on how familiar you are with the equipment you're using. You know, I've done some dramatic, you know, rapid-fire robot reprogramming in the middle of a presentation because the direction I was going just wasn't flying. You know, so don't be afraid to just, even if you see somebody just throws out a question, you know, out of the blue that looks like that might be worth pursuing, go there. There's always time to get back on track, okay? And most of all, have some fun with it. It doesn't have to be rigid. It doesn't have to be rigid and tutorial and all this noise. That's probably the best way to lose an audience right off the top. Okay, Cardiac. I'm going to give a quick rundown of resources, and then I'll shut up. And like I said, anybody has questions, that's why I say, you know, get in with questions as we go, because otherwise I ramble over time. And nuts.
You got to have back this pulled me up. With the torso.
There we go. Okay. Cardiac is available from an outfit called ComSpec Corporation in Amityville, New York. Okay. Yes.
I got mine from them. Mm-hmm. And it was made in 1968.
Well, okay. They might still be working off old Bell Lab stock. Who knows? I've talked to them. I've exchanged a few emails with them. They have a lot of them.
Yeah.
They've got a pile. They're like four.
When you get yours, open it up. Carefully, the waft of the old Bell Labs will come out.
Oh, I like it. I'll have to like open it in a bottle and try and store it. I'm going to order a few. You know, one that I can frame and the other I can actually use in presentations. Like I said, there's the address and their phone number if anyone's so inclined. It's about $14.95 a piece in shipping. So that's still out there. And it's a neat thing. It really is.
By the way,
yes.
Another thing worth mentioning is I noticed this fellow's selling those playing card decks.
Yeah.
Have the AND gates and the OR gates and such on. And I can imagine those being used.
Yeah, there's
they're $5.
Thank you. Yeah, the card decks over in the flea market area. Those are kind of cute. Those are good for logic design patterns and just, you know, have a little fun with again. And if anybody wants, you know, if anybody wants this later, come. I'll be running around here both days. Come find me. I've got it in my notes. I'll show it to you. Resources for the various operating system source codes. Here's a few URLs for like this is the unofficial CPM site, then the official Calera site, you know, the places for some of the Unix variants and the Linux. Again, if anybody wants this stuff and doesn't get it written down, you know, come grab me afterwards. I'll, you know, come look at my notes. I have it all printed up here. Otherwise, I'd never be able to keep track of what I'm doing. Then the references to the, and again, I guess I had Maniac on the mind. I'm sorry. The original publication where the tic-tac-toe playing machine was an article called Trial and Error in the Penguin Science Survey, Volume 2, printed in 1961 by Penguin Books. That one's kind of hard to find these days, but much easier is the this one, where they refer to her, the Martin Gardner article. I found this in one of my big used bookstores here about a week ago. This one's fairly easily accessible. Again, it's called The Unexpected Hanging and Other Mathematical Diversions. There's a lot of really entertaining stuff in it. Then again, the more contemporary stuff, the Cybex book that I've got up here, The Learning Guide to Computers, published by Cybex. It was published in 97. And that's it. I don't hear any snoring, so thank you.